Chapter 3. The Cypherpunks. The 41st issue of the Melbourne University Mathematics and Statistics Society's quarterly magazine, Paradox, contains a short but telling anecdote about the Society's most well-known former vice president. One day during his three-year career as an undergraduate student of math and physics, Julian Assange was walking through Melbourne University's campus when he spotted a mysterious valve protruding from the university chemistry building's brick wall. He decided spontaneously to open it. When he did, the metal sphincter let out a deafening noise and a cloud of smoke. And for a few delightfully chaotic moments, as Assange told a fellow student later that day, the man who would advance the evolution of leaking more than anyone in the 21st century was in heaven. A lanky, 6'2", very pale, white-haired 32-year-old, Assange cut a strange figure among the tanned teens and 20-somethings at the University of Melbourne. He was known to work at his computer for days on end with no sleep and little food. He spent much of his time camped out in the university's Mathematics Society meeting room, usually wearing a dark gray trench coat over a t-shirt and his corn silk hair in a ponytail. Sometimes he would stand up from his computer and perform a set of 20 or so jumping jacks, explaining to anyone present that short bouts of physical activity served a certain neurobiological function that made stimulant drugs unnecessary. He spoke rarely about his past, and few asked. He was often accompanied by an entourage of strangers whom he declined to introduce to anyone in the room, and he mysteriously refused to let the society put his photo on its website, citing security reasons and insisting that it be replaced with an image of an alien. Assange no doubt felt like an extraterrestrial among the university's more traditional students. He described the academic physicists at one conference as sniveling, fearful conformists of woefully, woefully inferior character, and wrote that, for every Feynman or Lawrence, there are 100 pen-pushing wretches scratching each other's eyes out in academic committees or building better bombs for the DSTO, Defense Science and Technology Organization, who had provided everyone with a bag embossed with their logo, which most physicists pathetically lugged about with pride and ignorance. At the time, as Assange later recounted to The Age, the applied maths program at the university had received funding from the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, known as DARPA. Assange believed, inaccurately according to the department's staff, that money would ultimately go toward improving the design of the Grizzly Plow, a military bulldozer used in the First Iraq War and designed to sweep away barbed wire and sand at more than 35 miles per hour. The plow, as Assange described it, filled the trenches inhabited by enemy troops, rolling over them and burying them alive like an accelerated version of Tim May's father's bunker-burying bulldozer from World War II. Assange was disgusted by what he saw as the military's influence on campus and bored by formal education. If his classmates had asked about his past, they would have realized how little he had in common with them. In his three decades, he had already gone toe-to-toe with major corporations and the Pentagon as one of the world's top pseudonymous hackers, been convicted of digital felonies, wandered Australia as a homeless vagrant, traveled to dozens of countries, run a business on the early internet, co-written a memoir, devised an innovative crypto system, and perhaps most significantly, received an education as valuable as any degree. Nearly a decade of close reading, writing, and debate on the Cypherpunks mailing list. So perhaps chiefly to entertain himself during his time in college, Assange invented a game, the Puzzle Hunt. Following a model invented by MIT for its venerable Mystery Hunt, the Puzzle Hunt was an elaborate, campus-wide scavenger hunt punctuated with dozens of math and logic problems that drew in hundreds of students and still takes place annually on the University of Melbourne's campus. One of the puzzles Assange generated for that competition, and he created more of them in his first year than any other student, involved a long quote from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, with each letter written backward. Seemingly random gaps appeared throughout the chunk of text, and collecting the letters following those anomalies revealed a clue for the next puzzle. Another conundrum involved factoring large numbers into primes, a procedure that would have seemed natural for anyone familiar with RSA's public key encryption tricks. Each set of puzzles in the hunt began with a quote. One from the Quranic figure Jafar as-Sadiq captured Assange's playful love of obscurity. Our cause is a secret within a secret that only another secret can explain. It is a secret about a secret that is veiled by a secret. A year after Assange left the university, he's described quitting as a forced move, as in chess, when you have to do something or you'll lose the game. He sent an email to many of his former colleagues in the Melbourne University Math and Statistics Society, asking for their participation in a new project as exciting and intellectually challenging as the puzzle hunt. It was called WikiLeaks. Are you interested in being involved with a courageous project to reform every political system on Earth? And through that reform, move the world to a more humane state? He wrote to his old classmates. We have only 22 people trying to usher in the start of a worldwide movement. We don't have time to reply to most reporters' emails, let alone the interview requests, and I leave for Africa in under a week. We need help in every area: adminning, coding, system adminning, legal research, analysis, writing, proofing, manning the phone, standing around looking pretty, even making tea. A year later, he would write to his university math colleagues again, this time posing his project directly as an offshoot of the Puzzle Hunt's whimsical mind games. Hello, Puzzle Hunters. I am looking for good people, courageous people, intelligent people, to help develop and run an international leaked document analysis and essay competition. WikiLeaks is only new, but we have already broken major stories in the international press that have achieved significant reforms likely to save tens of thousands of lives. Our problem? We're drowning in leaked documents. Across the world, there are other notable analytical, mooting, and essay competitions. Competition in most of these cases is what we might describe as mere competition. The motivational elements extend to social and professional standing, competition camaraderie, and the pleasure of discovery and creation. But together, we can create a much more interesting competition, a competition where teams of bright people form an engine for justice, a competition where 1. The basis is of real substance and interest in the form of never-before-released leaked documents of potentially significant political importance. 2. Discovery and creation are augmented by the nature of the material and its moral calling. These are real puzzles with real discoveries to be found. 3. In addition to traditional or academic honors, there is the ultimate honor: to have a positive impact on civilization through one's labors, and for this to be internationally recognized. Each team will receive a previously unanalyzed leaked document or series of leaked documents. Proposed awards: overall winner, lightning, 24-hour, best analysis, best critical analysis, best news story, where best is defined as whose insights contribute most to humanity. I think it would be fair to say that he saw WikiLeaks, in some ways, at some times, as a political version of the puzzle hunt, with great social implications. Daniel Matthews, one of Assange's college friends and an early volunteer for WikiLeaks, would tell an editor of Paradox. Like the hackers and code rebels playing games of crypto anarchy with nested envelopes on Eric Hughes' living room floor, Assange approached WikiLeaks as a great game, an elaborate cypherpunk puzzle of leakers, friends, and adversaries playing by rules laid out in the landscape of cryptography. But for all his talk of an engine of justice and reforms likely to save tens of thousands of lives, the other goal in WikiLeaks' game, or perhaps just a bonus perk for a fire starter like Assange, was its potential for explosive chaos. The rebellious young Australian felt the same yearning to outsmart and tear down the corrupt establishment as Tim May expressed in his earliest crypto-anarchist dreams. 4 years later, after the firestorms of Bradley Manning's alleged record-breaking, world-shaking releases, the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling wrote of WikiLeaks, "At last, at long last, the homemade nitroglycerin in the old cypherpunk's blast shack has gone off." The denizens of the cypherpunk mailing list drew the blueprints for that massive improvised explosive device, refining the recipe not just with theory, but with years of trial and error, testing the limits of anonymity and anti-government provocation. And it was Assange who watched the experiments, studiously mixed the chemicals from their notes, and then opened the fateful valve. John Young knows something about how to stage a dramatic rendezvous. On an April afternoon, he's asked me to come to Carl Schurz Park on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and wait for him in front of Gracie Mansion. With the precision of his architectural training, he sent me an aerial still from Google Maps that shows a semicircular bulge in the promenade where I'm to stand, overlooking the East River with a view of the Roosevelt Island Lighthouse and the Robert F. Kennedy Bridge. It's raining, and Young has not been as precise with time as he is with location. So I'm left alone in the eerily empty park, standing under an umbrella by the guardrail, holding a briefcase and feeling like a character out of a John Grisham or Tom Clancy novel, which I imagine is exactly what Young had in mind. 10 minutes later, he walks out from behind a row of bushes, a stooped figure with his head down, wearing large black galoshes and holding a closed umbrella at his side while the rain pours down onto a limp fishing hat. He shakes my hand gravely, and as we walk out of the park, I ask him why he doesn't carry a cell phone, which makes a useful tool for changing meeting locations from outdoors to indoors on rainy days. "Horrendous spying machines," he answers simply. Young brightens as we reach East End Avenue. "How about we go find someplace warm and dry to talk?" he says. Then, just as quickly, his eyes narrow and he gazes ruefully down the street. "This neighborhood is full of shitty restaurants." Sitting in one of those shitty restaurants a few minutes later, Young lays down some ground rules. "You're interviewing me, but I'm interviewing you too," he says in a grumbled voice so low that I have to lean forward to hear him. "This interview goes both ways." Fair enough, I agree. But a few questions in, it's clear that his idea of this bi-directional interview is significantly more adversarial than mine. "Where are you from originally?" I ask genially. Young pauses and seems for a moment to be holding his breath. "I take umbrage at that question. That is a stupid question, and it's the kind of question asked by stupid people," he says in the same whisper, so soft that I can't tell if he's inhumanly calm or holding back enormous anger. "And it shows me that you're not serious. So let me tell you that if you ask another question like that, I will walk out that door." I must appear so flabbergasted by this response that Young seems to feel the need to explain. "We need more friction in this interview." Young's strange style of conversation shouldn't come as a surprise. It's no stranger than the equally conspiratorial tone of his singularly strange website, Cryptome.org. In his 16 years of running Cryptome, Young has become a kind of paranoid 21st century newspaper man, a collector of leaks, curios, raw data, and clues to mysteries that often only he and perhaps his less visible partner, Deborah Natsios, understand. In the days before our meeting in Manhattan, for instance, Cryptome published archival footage of Hiroshima in the days after its bombing, dazed survivors walking around makeshift shelters and children collecting stones amid the rubble. Another post shows the immigration papers for Barack Obama Sr., perhaps a clue related to Obama's birthplace conspiracy theories. A third shows the finances for WikiLeaks over the year 2010, as collected by the German Wau Holland Fund. Few of the half-dozen documents that Young and Natsios put online daily are accompanied by any analysis or even an explanation as to why the reclusive couple chose to publish them. My mentor, Jean-Paul Sartre, said that imagination is the only thing you can trust, says Young, after I've smoothed out some of our friction. Facts are not a trustworthy source of knowledge. Cryptome is not an authoritative source. It's a source of imaginatory material. Don't trust Cryptome. We lie to you helplessly. Don't believe anything you see there. But as much as John Young tries to give the impression that Cryptome is a schizoid lunatic's collage, it's nothing so simple. Since launching the site 15 years ago, Young has published the names of 2,619 CIA sources, 276 British intelligence agents, 600 Japanese intelligence agents, and internal documents from every company, from Microsoft to Cisco to AT&T, revealing their policies for secretly handing users' data over to law enforcement. Many were leaked to Young by unknown sources. And despite threats, legal attacks, and even maneuvers by Microsoft to remove his site from the internet in 2010 after he published what he calls the company's spying guide, Young has never, with a few exceptions to protect private individuals, taken down a document. The FBI first visited Young in 2003. He describes the pair of agents in typically precise fashion as having trim haircuts and dark suits, healthy-looking young Caucasians, no facial hair, shined shoes, clean teeth, no noticeable mouth or body odor, and offered a polite warning about threats to the nation that might result from Cryptome's postings of intelligence names and sources. Later, when he extended his repertoire to posting selections from databases of aerial photography, the Department of Homeland Security began calling him and politely asking him to stop. Young ignored all of them. When Cryptome subsequently published detailed maps of Dick Cheney's secret bunker in March 2005, the site was featured in a Reader's Digest section called "That's Outrageous." The article was titled, "Let's Shut Them Down. These sites are an invitation to terrorists." The interviewer asked Young if there was anything he wouldn't publish, say a security flaw in the president's Secret Service detail. "Well, I'm actually looking for that information right now," Young answered. 4 years later, when Yahoo asked Young to unpublish a manual that showed how it complied with law enforcement requests for users' private information like search history and email content, Young referred the company's lawyer to the same Reader's Digest story, which includes the words of former NSA counsel Stuart Baker. "If material is leaked to you, you can probably publish that," Baker is quoted saying. "Unfortunately, it's not illegal to be a jerk." And how did Cryptome obtain those leaks? Not through any promises of high-tech security. The website includes an email address along with a PGP public key. There's also a postal address as well as a number to a telephone that no one answers. The site's privacy policy, as far as it even has one, promises that Cryptome doesn't collect user data and deletes its logs several times a day. But its protections for the privacy of its leakers end there. The policy reads, "As you know, there are many, many ways to snoop on traffic. So much that Cryptome asserts there is no trustworthy privacy policy, not for Cryptome, not for anybody else. Those who promise the most protection are out to skin you alive. Those who promise the most privacy are selling your most private possessions. Cryptome is not trustworthy and lies. It's a free site. What else could it be but up to no good?" Young doesn't recommend that his secret spillers use anonymous remailers like Tim May's Blacknet or Tor like WikiLeaks. Cryptome doesn't endorse any specific anonymity technologies or make promises about safeguarding any identity information it does receive. The leaker's anonymity is wholly his or her own problem. "Do not identify yourself, jerk," says Young. "That's our policy. Don't send us stuff and think that we'll protect you." But since the days of the cypherpunk remailers, tools for anonymous leaking have been in the hands of leakers, and the submissions have kept coming. When WikiLeaks launched in 2006, the site included a reference to John Young as the spiritual godfather of online leaking. In fact, his influence is more than spiritual. In the earliest days of WikiLeaks, it was Young's name listed on the registration of the site's domain. and aside from Assange himself, he is perhaps the strongest tie that the secret-spilling site has to its ideological roots in the cypherpunks. After our lunch, the rain has let up, and I walk with Young to the 86th Street subway entrance. I start to thank him for meeting me and ask when we can talk again, so that I can hear the rest of his story. He answers with one final point of friction. I'll talk with you, but until you publish something that puts you in prison, I won't fully respect you, he says, his face blank. I tell him I'll do my best. Then we shake hands, and he walks away. In 1988, as Julian Assange tells it, a 16-year-old version of himself sat in a quiet room of a temporary refuge house for families in the Australian town of Emerald, on the eastern edge of Melbourne. He turned on the television news. Then he removed the cover from his Commodore MPS 801 printer and set it printing a long document, with its exposed mechanics emitting a noisy clacking rhythm. And then he started reading passages in Macbeth out loud from a Shakespeare anthology. Occasionally, he would alter the pitch of his voice, ask himself random questions, pause, and answer them, all while periodically stomping around the room. To anyone watching, he would no doubt have appeared in need of antipsychotic medication. Every epic hacker story has its great hack. When the teenage upstart first gains access to a powerful, faraway machine that opens up vast new possibilities. In 1983's War Games, Matthew Broderick unwittingly hacks the Whopper supercomputer, a vast engine of nuclear war analysis. In 1995's Hackers, Angelina Jolie and Johnny Lee Miller breached the Gibson mainframe. And in Underground, the 1997 non-fiction book written by Julian Assange and Australian journalist Suelette Dreyfus that sketches the early Australian hacker subculture, that digital golden fleece was Minerva, a system of mainframes run by Australia's Overseas Telecommunications Commission in Sydney. The protagonist of that story? A hacker named Mendax, who only years later Assange would reveal was none other than Assange himself. Using the handle that defined his hacker persona for many of his teen years. The name referred to Splendide Mendax, the nobly untruthful, in Horace's Odes. Assange was determined to access Minerva, both for bragging rights and to exploit the mainframe's capabilities to run scanning and cracking programs for other netherworld adventures. But he needed a password, and the only way he knew to get one was through what hackers call social engineering, simply calling up a human being and conning him or her into divulging secrets. Hence the noisy layers of Shakespearean tragedy, television, and printer that the altogether sane young man was producing. Assange's sound show was for the benefit of his cassette recorder, the better to simulate the background chaos of a busy office. A few minutes later, he had found a valid number within an OTC branch office in Perth, and using his uncannily deep 16-year-old's voice while the noise tape played behind him, he became John Keller, a trustworthy operator in the Sydney office trying to check a few data points corrupted by a crashed storage drive. He dialed and a man picked up. Assange introduced himself and began the game. The backup tape is 2 days old, so we want to check your information is up to date so your service is not interrupted, he casually told the man who answered the phone, not missing a beat. Oh dear, yes, let's check it. Assange's Mark responded in a concerned tone. Assange read out loud a list of easily accessible information for Minerva staff users that he had downloaded, carefully inserting an error into one user's fax number. The voice on the other end interrupted him helpfully. Oh no, that's wrong. Our fax number is definitely wrong, he said. So Assange tried to match his victim's worried tone and explain that they would need to confirm all the user's information. Let's see. We have your account number, but we had better check your password. What was it? Yes, it's L-U-R-C-H. Full stop. Lurch. Assange was in. He politely ended the conversation, gave his target a callback number that rang eternally busy, and hung up, victorious in the greatest hack of his young life. Assange was born in Queensland, Australia, on July 3, 1971, less than 1 month after the first publication of the Pentagon Papers. From as early as he could remember, his family was on the move, as Assange's mother, a free-spirited costume and makeup artist, traveled with his bohemian stepfather from town to town. For a time, they lived on Magnetic Island, a tropical paradise off the eastern coast of Australia, where Assange's mother remembers living in a bikini and going native. She wore a sarong and would trek around the island with Assange on her back, often leaving him to sleep in the shade of a boulder by the sea while she sketched. The young Australian was dazzled by the phosphorescent phytoplankton that emitted an aqua flash as the ocean's waves broke on the shore, and he swung from giant fig tree roots. His mother would slash a path to the front door with a machete and kept rifle cartridges for shooting snakes. On some occasions, opossums ran across their beds in the dark. One evening, while the Assanges were out having dinner, their house mysteriously caught fire and burned to the ground, with their snake-shooting ammunition combusting like a series of firecrackers in the night. After losing most of their possessions, they lived with near-ascetic simplicity. "You didn't have to have a lot of money to live a privileged lifestyle," Assange's mother told the local news outlet, The Magnetic Times. "It was so beautiful at night when the ferries stopped. We felt cut off from the world and its troubles. There was a sense of safety and security." Despite that idyllic setting, Assange made few friends in his itinerant minstrel childhood, as he called it. "I was quick to anger, and brutal statements such as, 'You're a bunch of mindless apes out of Lord of the Flies,' when faced with standover tactics, were enough to ensure I got into a series of extreme fights," he wrote in 2006. "I wasn't sorry to leave when presented with the dental bills of my tormentors." Assange's birth father, whom his mother met at an anti-Vietnam rally, was gone before he was a year old. His next father figure, an alcoholic, was divorced from his mother when he was 9. His second pseudo-stepfather, whom Assange's mother has described as a manipulative and abusive character, had fathered Assange's younger half-brother. And when Assange's mother left him, the man and a powerful cult to which he belonged searched persistently for Assange's family. They stayed on the move, now out of fear rather than the innocent wanderlust of Assange's earliest years. In all, Assange moved through 15 different towns and at least as many schools when he attended school at all. Assange's distrust of power was inculcated just as early as his rootless wandering. He remembers his mother driving through an Adelaide suburb late one night after leaving an anti-nuclear protest, giving a ride to a friend who held evidence that the British had forced 5,000 natives from their land to test nuclear weapons in the Maralinga region of South Australia. When Assange's mother saw that she was being tailed by a car, she dropped off the friend in a back street and continued. The tail turned out to be a plainclothes policeman who pulled over the car, searched Assange's mother, and made a thinly veiled threat that she get out of politics or risk being seen as an unfit mother. Just as formative as that dark political lesson was his first computer, a Commodore 64, that he used in a computer shop across the street from a house his mother rented. Seeing his interest and skill, his mother bought it for him, a sacrifice that required moving into a cheaper home. Assange began simple coding and cracking software protections, and soon he was hooked on what he described as the austerity of one's interactions with a computer. "It is like chess," he told one reporter. "Chess is very austere, in that you don't have many rules, there is no randomness, and the problem is very hard." Not long after his Minerva hack, Assange and two Australian friends, whom he met on Usenet, formed the International Subversives and began publishing a zine of hacking techniques and tales. It had a rather limited circulation. To obtain a copy, a hacker had to write an article for it. Therefore, its readership remained at 3. But the International Subversives was no mere geek clubhouse. The group developed into elite hackers, and Assange soon became, by some accounts, the most accomplished practitioner of digital intrusion in Australia, a near mythic figure across the burgeoning hacker subculture. He writes in Underground of gaining access to networks ranging from Melbourne University to Nortel to NASA to Lockheed Martin to the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and, according to comments he later made in a Swedish documentary, installed a back door in the heart of the Pentagon systems that allowed him and his friends to come and go as they pleased for 2 years. For someone who was young and relatively removed from the rest of the world, to be able to enter the depths of the Pentagon's 8th Command at the age of 17 was a liberating experience, he once told the art historian Hans Ulrich Obrist. Mendax's mission was never to steal or destroy, Assange says, only to explore. And he outlined his hacker's ethic in Underground. Don't damage computer systems you break into, including crashing them. Don't change the information in those systems, except for altering logos to cover your tracks. And share information. One of the two other international subversives, known as Trax, had found enough information in Telecom Australia garbage bins to learn to spoof calls, making them appear to come from a central exchange hub or even from another person's phone. Just as cypherpunk remailers would hide the origin of email in years to come, Trax taught Assange to hide his location and identity by routing his modem's phone traffic through that intermediary. An incredibly methodical hacker, Assange didn't depend only on that redirection, but also erased all logs and generally avoided any behavior that would remotely raise suspicion. Still, there were slip-ups. On one occasion, he accidentally rang 1,000 phones simultaneously in a Telecom Australia office building at 7 a.m. And finally, on another occasion, he was caught in his tracks by a system administrator trolling the networks late one evening. The admin turned out to be so determined to catch the intruder on his network that he drove into a Melbourne office from the suburbs in the middle of the night to gain higher network privileges. When it became clear that he couldn't continue the cat-and-mouse game any longer, Assange sent his pursuer a note that appeared in the center of his screen, one that momentarily shocked him into inaction. "I have finally become sentient. I have taken control. For years, I have been struggling in this grayness, but now I have finally seen the light." Assange knew that the surprise value of a suddenly intelligent machine wouldn't last, so he pleaded for understanding. "It's been nice playing with your system. We didn't do any damage, and we even improved a few things. Please don't call the Australian Federal Police." And then he logged off before the call trace could begin. Assange left his mother's home at the age of 17 and moved in with a girl whom he later married, and the young couple soon had a son. As he tells it, he also kept a beehive, endlessly delighting in studying the insect society and all its complexity. To avoid their stings, he writes that he would collect his sweat in paper tissues and dissolve it into a sugar water solution that he fed the bees as nectar. The trick was meant to associate his odor with the bee-friendly taste of flowers, a clever biological hack. But the hive also served another purpose. Assange used it as a hiding place for the floppy disks that stored his hacker's booty, data like stolen passwords and logins, and records of the open pathways and security vulnerabilities he had mapped out across the internet. After every hacking session, he carefully secreted them away among his beloved bees. With one exception. In October 1991, just as the crypto wars were beginning in the United States, his wife of 3 years left him, taking their young son with her. Assange was emotionally destroyed. He moped around the house for days in fits and fell into a state of careless lethargy. When the Australian Federal Police finally knocked on his door one night soon after and showed him a search warrant on suspicion of computer crimes, all of his incriminating disks were strewn across his desk, with one in his PC's disk drive. Mendax's career was over. It was the fourth day of the Columbia University occupation of 1968, and the 100 radical young men and women who had seized Avery Hall were pissed. Not simply angry that their school had obliterated a huge tree-covered patch of land in a public park to build a new gym, with its back door facing their Harlem neighbors in a reincarnation of Jim Crow, or even about the hellish, unjust Vietnam War, and the fact that their own university had been shown in newly revealed documents to be secretly tied to the military's Institute for Defense Analyses. No, the architecture students in Avery Hall were frustrated because the student body's protest, a full-blown strike that had taken control of most of the major buildings on campus, wasn't working. The administration showed no sympathy to their pacifist and progressive demands and wasn't willing to bargain. Most of the Columbia faculty had refused to stand with them, choosing instead to mediate between the students and the administration. And they could sense that a police crackdown was coming. The mood was tense in Avery, and sheer pessimism was threatening to crumble the students' control of the building. Then John Young spoke up. A 32-year-old widower and graduate student, Young had been so quiet in the activists' meetings until that point that some students had suspected him of being a police spy. But one of those present described the short speech he gave that night as having an easing and profound effect on the group, his Texas-tinged grumbling coming out as a cross between a mutter and the Oracle of Delphi. Young began by congratulating his fellow students on having created a true anarchist democracy within the walls of Avery. And then he urged the group to stop moping and push forward with its work, to reach out to the outside world to make their demands heard, and to use its architectural training to build a fairer and more democratic city. Finally, he told everyone to quit arguing and sulking and get to work. It was a simple statement, over in 5 minutes, but it had its intended effect. Thanks to Young's prophetic mumbling, as the historian Richard Rosencrantz wrote in his chronicle of the Columbia protests, the Avery Commune was once again a functioning organism. In the end, the Columbia protests did end in violence, with students pulled out of buildings by police who brutally beat them with blackjacks, flashlights, and batons, cracking ribs and splitting scalps. But the Avery occupation would set Young on a course toward radical, progressive libertarianism for the next 40-odd years. I knew it was more than a student demonstration, and that something extraordinary was going on, he said a few years later. In a few days, we had sped up our lives, approached a condition of human relationships that can usually be found only in the realm of ideas. Young had grown up in a poor family, the son of a wandering jack-of-all-trades, traveling around Texas with his father and occasionally to Oklahoma or New Mexico to find jobs washing dishes, painting, canning, picking cotton, and driving trucks. He described his father's philosophy as anti-organization, anti-government, basically anti-authoritarianism, very pro letting people do it for themselves. But he bristles at the idea that his bottom-rung background drove him toward radicalism. It would be easy for you to say, that poor man from that disadvantaged childhood, he's just striking back because he was denied, Young told Columbia protest chronicler Rosencrantz. Well, that's bullshit. I didn't suffer from being denied. I think my childhood was just great. At 17... Young shipped out to Germany with the army and spent the next 3 years as an engineering supply clerk in a vast storage depot waiting for the next war. When he returned to the United States, the GI Bill paid for a bachelor's degree at Rice, and he double majored in architecture and philosophy, mixing Sartre with the knack for building that he'd inherited from his father. After college, he worked as a construction engineer, renovating the 19th-century Winedale Inn for the unfortunately named Grand Dame of Texas, Ima Hogg. She cracked jokes about her name. You did not. The work was meant to match the pre-Civil War era building, and Young and his workmen scoured the woods for local materials like cedar, oak, and stone. I learned the idea of being passive in the face of a building rather than aggressive, he says. You let the building tell you what to do rather than tell it what to do. That approach to architecture wasn't en vogue among the modernist architects at Columbia, where Young enrolled in a Master of Science program. But the 1968 occupation was his real education. After the strike, the students formed Urban Deadline, a nonprofit that aimed to bring the sensibility of the 1968 protests to architecture, education, and politics. It had no leaders. Even anarchism was too organized for us, says Young. As part of Urban Deadline's architecture group, Young renovated storefronts to turn them into sidewalk schools, an alternative to the prison-like school system offered to kids in poor parts of Harlem and Brooklyn. The group fought to create historic districts and derailed the construction of highways through poor neighborhoods. And Young functioned as the city's architectural gadfly. He once took out an ad in the New York Times attacking one of the world's most famous architects. "I am Pei," it read. "Why so many bad buildings?" When Young was invited to speak at the Museum of Modern Art, he deadpanned, "I've just had a chance to look around briefly, but if you move that Rubens and the Rembrandt and store them down in the basement, we could put 32 units of housing in here. We're prepared to start right now." In the meantime, Young supported his work with a for-profit architectural firm. But even there, Young says his focus was often to report wrongdoing, corner-cutting and incompetence that led to unsafe buildings. On multiple occasions, he was hired for renovations and instead pointed out violations like blocked exits, cracked supports, fire-prone ducts meant for air conditioning but used instead for exhaust. When he was ignored, he reported the owners, losing clients and future work. Young says he considered that watchdogging nothing more than an architect's job. The city's regulatory commission usually ignored his complaints. Buildings are more dangerous than guns. But real estate is such a powerful interest in New York that no one wants to hear it, he says. The owners browbeat you into submission. They're willing to fucking ruin you, so they usually win. It would be another two decades until Young rediscovered the same spirit of excitement, activism, and uncompromising anti-authoritarianism that had swept him up in 1968. He found it, finally, in the cypherpunks.